Moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, gonna eat me a lot of peaches. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Comic Book Herald Live. Hey everybody, I'm Dave Busing, founder and editor-in-chief of comicbookherald.com. Today, we are going to talk Ultimate X-Men, number one. What is going on in Marvel's Ultimate Universe? What is going on in Ultimate X-Men? What is Peach Momoko doing here? What else is exciting and good in the world of comics? Now, we are in a new month. It is March 2024, as many of you may not be aware. I did publish my favorite graphic novels and reads over on CBH and in the CBH newsletter of February 2024. We may go through that on this live stream, depending on what kind of questions and things you have, but I wasn't here last week, so we got a little catching up to do. We got to talk Resurrection and Magneto. We got to talk Immortal Thor, talk the whole Al Ewing Marvel Comics landscape, and of course, Ultimate X-Men number one, as well as any interesting news and developments that may be coming up. Maybe next week we do the official rundown of the February faves. And again, you can find all those on comicbookherald.com. Published in every month, my favorite graphic novels and collections released each month, which is my favorite thing I'm doing because it keeps me super attuned to new stuff, to exploring new comics, which is like always my favorite thing. Like my favorite things right now are like my kids getting obsessed with Dogman. Okay. My oldest is head over heels in love with Dogman. We went from hasn't read a page to read all of them in the span of like 4 hours and now has read them 6,000 times. We are a full-on Dogman household. I am open. Here's your challenge for today, fellow parents or just fellow lovers of comics for kids. What are your recommendations for kids' comics in the vein of Dogman? There's like a 95% chance, like a 95% chance the Comic Book Herald just becomes full-on Comic Dad Herald. I think we're going to have a little Daddy Dave care going on. And it's starting with Dogman. Oh my good grief, these are popular. Good God. So listen, if you're not here for kids' comics conversation, it's not looking good for you. It's not looking great. But okay, if you got Dogman Rex, get him in here for the kids. But yeah, we're going to talk Ultimate X-Men. We're going to talk Resurrection Magneto. Talk about what's going on. Marvel announced that X-Men number 35, which comes out in June, will be the final issue of the entire Krakoa era. They're putting a bow on it, and they are also doubling it as Uncanny X-Men number 700. Now, I actually like a lot Marvel's approach of, okay, if we're gonna reboot and renumber all the time, let's just also include the legacy numbering, right? I think for old heads and for just people who've been around for a long time, like the history and the nature of keeping these properties going for decades now is one of the hooks of ongoing narratives in the Marvel Comics universe. So the legacy numbering, you know, getting past an issue 500, hitting an Uncanny X-Men number 700, that's cool. That's unique. Right. And obviously for Marvel and DC, they're like, yeah, and that's also a huge sales opportunity. Right. So like the cynical corporate side of things is like it's a moneymaker, which, OK, great, do that. But just from like a fan perspective, I like legacy numbering. I do. I actually personally find it less intimidating than recycling and rebooting with new number ones like every year. Like, I think it's easier for someone to follow sequential numbers and the ancient art of counting than it is to like somehow have the knowledge or have to use a site like CBH that's like, oh yeah, so you recapped Marvel volume 3, then volume 4, then volume 5, right, which are all in the span of like 3 to 4 years. That stuff gets needlessly confusing fast. I don't know why the big two never adopted, I was just talking about this today on Twitter, I don't know why they never adopted a seasons approach a la TV. Right. Especially over the last, like, throughout the 2010s, where it's like, clearly we are faster to publish a new number one of a book. Clearly that timeline accelerated a lot. I get it from a sales standpoint, right? Just look at what we're going to talk about today. Ultimate X-Men number one. Look at Ultimate Spider-Man number one. Look at Ultimate Black Panther number one. Launching a new number one gets eyeballs. It gets a lot of attention in a way that's saying, hey, check out Black Panther number 594. It just doesn't have the same effect. It doesn't. So I get that. But if you're going to do that, I feel like there is a have your cake and eat it too thing where it's just like, why not just annually have seasons? Why not just annually be like 2024, this is season five. Legacy numbering can be included on the book. For those who are aware, it allows you to have your milestones, right? There's no reason you can't do both things, but it's so chaotic. It's so chaotic. Secret Wars was the perfect opportunity. Was the perfect opportunity to say, okay, everything just died. Basically, we canceled every book. We're all coming back. Season one. But no. that has not happened to date. Will it ever? I don't know. Here's why it's weird that Marvel's calling X-Men number 35 Uncanny X-Men number 700. Because the book's not Uncanny X-Men. Nor has it been. So in order to get to a number 700, and this is like the kind of math that only a true comics nerd can appreciate here. In order to get to an Uncanny X-Men number 700, you have to count from Uncanny X-Men the Jonathan Hickman written X-Men series and then the Jerry Duggan written X-Men series, both of which have been published as adjectiveless X-Men. Does this seem like the kind of inside nerd minutia that does not matter? Yeah, absolutely. Like it's the least important thing that I'm kind of bothered about today, right? Like of the things that bother me today, this is definitely the least important one of all of them. By far, it will impact no one in any significant way, thank goodness. But it is weird. It's really weird to call it retroactively. Like, oh yeah, that was Uncanny the whole time. No, it wasn't. That means something. That's the flagship. I fully expect that when the new era launches, and when Gail Simone is officially announced, it's going to be on Uncanny X-Men. And that's going to mean something. But apparently it's going to be on Uncanny X-Men number 701 with the non-legacy numbering of Uncanny X-Men number one and with no seasons attached, so it'll stay as confusing as it's ever been. Did I just announce that Gail Simone's going to be on Uncanny X-Men? Listen, I did the Uncanny X-Men fantasy draft with David Harper over on Sketched about a week and a half ago now. I think that podcast got a lot of good feedback. Thanks to those of you who listen here on my stuff, who've hopped over there to, I feel like I need all of you to go boost those numbers, right? Really, really, let's get a fan campaign going to show David that I have some merit and that maybe he'll invite me back because it was super fun to go on off panel and get to do that. I would love to do something like that again. But in that, we picked, like, who do we think our creatives are going to be? What are the titles going to be? I'll share the document that I had later in this because I there's a bunch of stuff on there that I didn't get to pick. But one, there were two predictions that were, like, lead pipe locks, which is, I think that was a White Sox thing. I think growing up, that was one of the White Sox, like, in-game promotions was the lead pipe locks. Okay? And maybe they still do that. I don't know. I don't watch Sox games hardly ever. I'm not anti-Sox. It's kind of like a Marvel DC thing for me, Cubs Sox. I'm actually seeing the question here in the comments. I've never been anti-Sox. Like, I wasn't mad when they won the World Series. They're just not my team. I've always aligned more with the Cubs. But there's like a little bit of Chicago pride if they're doing well. Like I'm into both teams doing well. It's just way more important to me when the Cubs are doing well. Like I'm a fan of the Cubs. I am a, I don't know, I'm pleasantly supportive, I guess. I'm not angry about the White Sox, right? It's not like the Cardinals. Like, the Cardinals are an actual nemesis, right? Like, anything out of Milwaukee is an actual nemesis. Obviously, the Packers, right? Okay. So, why am I saying Gail Simone's Uncanny X-Men? All right, listen, on the podcast, we talked about this. You should go listen to it. You should boost my numbers, boost my cred. But, so we knew Gail Simone was going to be writing something. Okay, she's already been announced months ago now, writing an X-Men story in the Free Comic Book Day special. Marvel pretty much always uses those to sort of set up what's to come in their universes. The only question, and I think we all got a little bit in our heads on this one, the only question was, Well, will Gail actually be like the flagship writer? Or will it be she's writing what I predicted in the podcast, which was Generation X? We knew Jubilee would be involved. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Be kind of like a Generation X thing. I think there's some questions. Maybe the reason people are unsure is one, Marvel didn't announce anything formal. So it was kind of like, well, maybe this is like if they're going to put her name on it, but then not make the announcement. That's kind of weird, you know? So maybe it's not actually her like leading, like driving the charge and writing the flagship. But what was released today is the announcement of this X-Men 35 being the final Krakoa issue. One of the writers involved is Gail Simone. And all right, we got her writing a free Comic Day special. We got her writing a story in the final Krakoa era X-Men book in June. Lock it in. Lock it in. Gail Simone's writing X-Men. She's writing Uncanny X-Men. I think she's going to be the head. I think she's going to be like, I don't know that I want to call it head of X because this one seems to be way more editorially driven. It seems like Tom Brevoort is the de facto head of X, you know, the way this has been positioned. Which obviously just like creatively is less instantly intriguing and probably exciting than Jonathan Hickman, right? With that sort of catalog. It's going to be Gail Simone. Lock it in. Stop like pretending it's not happening. It's happening. For those of you who don't really know Gail Simone's work, I'm actually curious, like what is the familiarity level with Simone? Because I think she's a really well-known creator at this point. But that said, if you're just looking like within the last like 14 year, 10, the last decade, you know, what's the big two output? What are and I'm not saying what's the good output. That's not what I'm getting at. I'm saying like, what's like the stuff that really had her in the spotlight. You know what I mean? When I think of that stuff, it's the, from 2000 to 2010, Birds of Prey, Secret Six, which I loved, Batgirl, probably up and through the New 52. That was all pretty big. But post like 2014, I don't know, on the Marvel side especially, like it's like a lot of oddball miniseries. Like there's a, what is it, a Shang-Chi or Domino? It's Domino, maybe with Shang-Chi in the book. You know, but hasn't been writing big stuff for Marvel. So I don't really have a pulse. I know she's a really well-known creator. I don't have a good pulse on like, what is current modern fandom's relationship and expectations of that writer on a book like X-Men? Like what kind of impact does Gail on X-Men have compared to a Tom King, a James Tynion, Jonathan Hickman, even like a Rom V, like an up-and-coming, or even like a Jed McKay, like somebody who's in Marvel, has that sort of publicity? I do not have a good perspective of that at all. So I'm curious. I don't know. It will definitely be interesting. Like I said, I loved her Secret Six. I need to go and read some of Gail's creator-owned stuff. I think Clean Room is a big one that folks are really into. I have not touched that, so I cannot speak to it. I need to go read that, especially if she's going to be doing X-Men. I'm going to be super curious on that. Birds of Prey was great. Let's see. What are people saying? We got Justin saying, Simone in the zone. Could be amazing, but editorial needs to let her cook. Always true. Always true. Jordan says, New 52 Batgirl. Lothargo says, Batgirl. Open Mike Eagle says, I only know Gail Simone from Twitter. Yeah, honestly, like a huge Twitter presence, a huge social presence. I think a very big, just like comics and fandom presence. You know, it seems she's really tapped in and has built up like a pretty sterling reputation. Let's see, women in refrigerators. That comes from her, I think. Did she coin that term? I think she coined fridging back when she was like before she like really broke into the industry. I don't fully know the history of that, but I think that's true. Let's see. Jasper says Birds of Prey run is amazing. Chris Cuevas says Secret Six and Wonder Woman. Yeah. Oh, Trap God Thanos points out she did. Oh, that's right. She did that Jessica Jones mini, the variants. I actually haven't read that. Okay. But yeah, it's a lot of like kind of off the beaten path mini stuff. Coining fridging is, I mean, that's a legacy, right? That's kind of like the Bechdel test, where it's like, yeah, she wrote Fun Home, but the Bechdel test is the thing everyone's going to be talking about. It's an interesting pick. I think on one hand, I like it in the sense that, yes, great, let's have a woman lead the flagship. I think that's something that is often not Marvel's go-to. Historically, it has not been Brie Vort's casting, you know, within the last decade. What do we got? We got Dan Slott on Fantastic Four. We got Ryan North on Fantastic Four. We got Jason Aaron, Jed McKay on Avengers. Before that, Hickman. Before that, Bendis, right? That's not something he's really done. Now, artistically, maybe a little bit. You got Sarah Pacelli on Fantastic Four with Dan Slott, but she only lasted like 2 or 3 issues, and what the heck happened there? But I think that's good, right? Let's allow for that perspective. And Gail Simone obviously has an incredible resume. Give her some room, right? Like Justin said, let her cook. On the other hand, it does not capture a feeling of freshness. It does not capture a feeling of being tapped into the now. And I think that is a fear for this era, for both myself and a lot of fans, that like this is the back to basics era. This is going to be the regressive era. A lot of that is like the assumptions are way overblown, you know. I think even Brie Vort in the newsletters is like, we're going to do some weird stuff, y'all. Like, it's not like, I think he's going to both sides it, but at the same time, like, they're going to make some choices. They're going to do some interesting things. I think the assumption that it is going to be blue and gold team playing softball in Westchester is probably a false one. Okay. That said, like, going with like old guard industry standard favorites as your creative selections does not assuage those fears in quite the same way. So I'm definitely interested. I'll definitely be reading it, but I can't pretend that I'm like over the moon jazzed about it. I can't pretend that it's the type of pick that would really have me like sitting up in my seat, like Peach Momoko on Ultimate X-Men announcement. That had my eyes open. Excitement, immediate reaction of like, wow, I did not see that coming. I did not see that coming. So anyway, time will tell. I saw some reaction to the X-Men 35 thing that they were like, oh, Krakoa officially dying. It's like, y'all, stop holding on to hope. What are you doing? What if at this point, if you kind of follow comics news and you're still like, I don't know if they're going to get rid of Krakoa, like, stop it. What are you doing? They're clearly moving on. They're clearly going to do their own thing. Okay. And it's a huge challenge succeeding this era. I think that this, and I've said this before, this era is going to be retroactively beloved. It's weird how it's kind of at the end here because there's a little fizzle and there's, you know, some rush stuff and it's not ending with a cohesive bang, even though I think Gillen stuff's really good. I think Ewing stuff's really good. And then, you know, even Steve Fox, right, doing this wild stuff on Dead X-Men. It's not like there's not interesting comics right now. But I think there's maybe a perception or maybe even a false one. Y'all are probably more tapped in the perception of this than I am. But, like, just a perception that it's like Krakoa was real controversial and, you know, it was an experiment and, you know, it was half and half. Fans loved it. Fans hated it. It's like that was not the journey. that was not, I lived through it. It was, I mean, as approval ratings go, as unanimous love goes for a thing, I mean, House and Powers has not been beaten in my lifetime. Name a comics event that drove more enthusiasm and new readers and just interest in a franchise that seems stuck than House and Powers. I don't think he can do it. Okay, so this perception like, oh, so controversial. It's like, that feels overblown. But anyway, it's going to be a challenge to succeed it. I think it's going to be Gail Simone. Man, it would be a real impressive head fake if it wasn't. Like, it would actually be pretty funny if they were like, yeah, and she's not involved. Just writing the Free Comic Day thing and has a little story in X-Men 35, a.k.a. Uncanny X-Men number 700. Well, I'm going to lose sleep over that. That numbering is insane. Anyway, but no, she's not involved. Like, that'd be like the ball's right here. It's like half out of her hands. Look at this form. Come on. You know, I play. Look at that form. All right. Ball's halfway out of her hands. And the ref's like, what, Kevin, you cannot shot fake a free throw. What are you doing? That's what Marvel would be doing. If Gail Simone, recent reference to Kevin Durant, shot faking a free throw. I'm sure y'all caught that. I'm sure y'all on the same page there. Okay. Xavier says, what's not controversial in America? Fair point. Fair point. Justin says, controversial because of what? I think the anti-Krakoa crowd, which is like a lot, it's a lot of, it's a combination of the grifting hate machine. So throw that out. And then it's like the fans who are like, this is not X-Men anymore, which is a little more debatable. At least it's a little more of a conversation in the sense of like, you have a fandom that is like, I really like when the X-Men are trying to establish peace and mutant-human relations, and they view Krakoa as this like isolationist separatist movement that is at odds with what they view the purpose of X-Men to be. Now, I disagree with that. That's why I made a video that is like probably one of the best ones I did, which is called Why the X-Men Aren't the Villains of Krakoa or whatever, right? But those conversations have been happening. It's not always done with grifting hate-mongering in mind, I don't think. But I get that those voices are definitely louder as the thing ends. And I think there's a false shouting of victory from the crowd that has wanted it to die and has hated what is happening and has seen the attention it brings them to hate that. I think they're getting louder and louder as it ramps up to a conclusion, which is in no way fueled by their efforts, but they'll take credit for it all the same, right? So I think that's where the perception of controversy comes from. I think it's a very small pocket of I don't even want to call it fandom, but that's my read on it. Okay, Trap God Nano says Coby White is the GOAT. That's the first true comment I've seen in the chat today. I would like you all to bring the truth. The Trap God Thanos is a great, great name, by the way. I would like you all to emulate Trap God. Be a little more like your brother. That's all I'm saying. Okay. What else do we got today? We talked about Uncanny X-Men number 700, probably way longer than I expected to. Any questions? Vass says, we're getting them back at the X-Mansion, aren't we? Sigh. I don't know. Yeah, they'll be in some kind of large building. Yes, for sure. It's not going to be. I'd be surprised if it was as obvious as a literal return to the mansion in Westchester. I'm still like, can we be on Araco? Can we be on the moon? Is something going to change here? I'm still holding out that hope. Okay, I definitely am. Chris says, I've seen a lot of people bash Krakoa, but it's clear they haven't read any of it, especially when I hear it all went downhill after Hickman. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that too, right? Just like, I think there's a sense of Krakoa being this really progressive experiment, both politically and narratively, which is crazy. You know, it's like, it's just like these small measures of diversity within the flippin' Disney Marvel corporate landscape, and then being treated as like, you know, like every character is trans and queer now. Like, is there a single trans character in this entire book, right? Like, listen, it's not pushing the needle nearly as much as they'd like their audiences to believe. But anyway, yes, I think that's a lot of it. Again, if you hear it all went downhill after Hickman, turning point, yes. Kieran Gillen and Al Ewing did better work in X-Men comics than Jonathan Hickman did after House and Powers. I don't even think that's controversial, okay? Could you throw anyone else into that mix? I want to say Victor Laval, but that's, you know, it's kind of a cheat, just some minis. But I genuinely think that. I think Gillen and Ewing wrote better ongoings than Hickman did in the X-Men universe before Hickman bailed. Whatever happened there. I think really we know what happened there. I would love the oral history of that, just to like put the kibosh on all the salacious attitude of it. It is wild. You know, I was listening to, I went back, this is recent, this is in like last week and a half. I know it's the kind of thing some people don't like to relitigate. It's done, it's over, it's past, right? We got great comics out of Gillen. We got great X-Men comics out of Al Ewing. It is what it is. Here we are, right? But I was going back and I listened to the interview that Hickman did with Connor on Cerebrocast. I listened to it like within the last like 2 weeks. So I'm like 6 months late. It is fascinating the transparency and the insight he gives into like confirming, for example, that like, yeah, Brian Hill did not get the memo about Fallen Angels. It was super unfair to him. And that was something I was positing as we were criticizing it in the moment. It was like, it feels like this guy didn't get the memo. And he literally didn't. He wasn't a part of the meetings. And it's like those, that kind of behind the scenes stuff I always find super fascinating, because obviously it shapes kind of how you view the work. But the one takeaway I had from that interview, which I will say I was pretty impressed. I thought Connor improved as an interviewer quite a bit, at least in the first half of that interview with Hickman. I actually haven't finished it. But anyway, it is weird that given when you actually like refresh the context and you think about like Marvel had to dump money and probably some power at Hickman's door to get him to come back. He left Marvel with no intention of coming back. Now, maybe there's some internal behind-the-scenes stuff where it's like Hickman thought he was selling East of West to Amazon, and then that died. And then he was like, well, maybe I need to make this career move again and get my brand back in Marvel, which I think has been a brilliant move for him professionally. But like, I think Marvel had to woo him to come back. House and Powers are successes beyond their wildest dreams. The idea that when a vote came up and it was like, do y'all want to move on a la Jonathan's plan, or do you want to stay in Krakoa? I don't know. At the time, I was very willing to accept that, like, well, Hickman's a team player, and it's clear everybody kind of wants to stay, and he doesn't want to do that. But he's a real team player. This is the team he assembled. You can hear a real love in his voice when he's talking about working with this crew in this way, which feels authentic, right? He wasn't going to disrupt that. That all makes sense. But if I'm Jordan White or C.B. Cebulski or who's the president? Buckley? Dan Buckley. That shouldn't even get to a vote. It shouldn't. Like an executive decision somewhere should have been like, hey, you know what we need for this to keep blowing everybody's doors off? We need Jonathan in the room. And maybe Hickman then is the one who's like, well, no, everybody doesn't want to do that. I'm walking. And it's his decision. It's his personal choice, which is fine. Right? But it's so wild to me that they kind of let that happen. I don't think editorial forced him out. I don't believe any of that conspiracy nonsense. I kind of don't even think there's probably like super bad blood, frankly. But man, it's weird. It's got very Bull's Last Dance energy, like big time Bull's Last Dance energy, where it's like, we got Jordan, Pippen, Rodman, Jerry. We could probably win another title, you know, and it's not going to be with Tim Floyd and Ron Artest. Y'all know what I'm saying? Anyway. That was going through my head listening to that again. It's a good interview. Highly recommend it. Okay. Any final questions before we start talking the comics today? Justin says, Ewing absolutely wrote a better ongoing X-Men than Hickman. Yes, no question. Kenji says, I think people were too focused on the pretty large amount of mediocre to bad books during Krakoa that they don't acknowledge how some were new all-time classics. Yeah, I think the like 5 years from now, like retrospective, like how is the Krakoa era, is you're going to have fewer people trying to read everything. It's also going to be a lot easier to read everything. You're not going to have to go to your LCS and buy 15 books. It's just all going to be on Marvel Unlimited and you can pick and choose, you know, but it's going to be a lot easier just to be like, what's the cream of the crop, right? And just to be like, oh man, I'm just doing Immortal X-Men and X-Men Red. It's going to feel awesome. Like I look at this in context of what's around it in terms of X-Men comics. You know, readers in the future are going to be like, hey, I think I like this X-Men thing. What should I read? And the answers are going to be Claremont, Morrison, Krakoa. That's it. That's where they're going to be sent. I'm going to be sending them there. You know? So yes, it is definitely going to shift back to a very positive assessment, I think. Okay. Let's talk. One question here from Banksy. Banksy says, Hickman talks about how we would have never been able to guess who the final big bad is. I wonder if it was OG Nathaniel Essex, and if not, then who? Well, that's where Kieran went. If not OG Nathaniel Essex, and presumably not Moira, because that feels like a guess, who would the final big bad of Hickman's X-Men have been? Ultron. That's my guess. All right. On to comics. Let's start with the Ultimate X-Men. It is the latest entry in the Marvel Ultimate Universe. Listen, I called my broker again today. I said, take all my funds. They said, sir, I said, take all my funds, move them into Marvel's Ultimate Universe. They said, sir, this is a Wendy's. I said, move all the funds into Ultimate Universe Comics. They hung up. Okay? But I've been saying it for weeks. It has been proven with each launch issue just how right I am. Put all of your funds and your effort and your energy and your interest and your trust and your love in Marvel in the Ultimate Universe. It's all right here, baby. Okay, Peach Momoko's Ultimate X-Men number one delivers. It delivers hard. It delivers. I actually had hyped myself up so much that I had actually already bounced back down before I started reading it and was like, all right, I'm tempering expectations. No way this can live up. It did. It did actually live up to my expectations. You know how many mutants we saw today? Arguably one. That's hilarious for an Ultimate X-Men number one. Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate Black Panther, they are satisfying itches that longtime fans have had. Ultimate X-Men is actually doing something new, or at least it feels that way right now. Certainly the vision of it all. It's the first time in the last decade that you could have handed me a Marvel comic, but like if I hadn't seen the cover, right, and I didn't know anything, and they were like, yeah, it's a new graphic novel from, you know, like a publisher that's known for great cartoonist, like creator-driven work, right? They were like Drawn Quarterly or First Second or who's another? Even like Scholastics, like graphics, right? There's kind of that all-ages feel. I would have believed you. I haven't had that experience with a Marvel comic in ages. In ages. Ultimate X-Men number one is excellent. It is exactly what I've been talking about when I say I'm looking for unencumbered creative identities in Marvel. I want to have books that feel like they are driven by creative vision and are allowed to move at their own whims. And Ultimate X-Men really feels like that. It is also going to be confusing as hell for most readers, right? Myself included. In a lot of ways, right? You see Ultimate X-Men number one just as like, and you don't know a thing about Peach Momoko and you haven't been sitting waiting around for this and you pick up this book and you're like, where the hell is Wolverine, Cyclops, Jean, Professor, Magneto? What is this? Hisako Ichiki? Who? Armor? I think I have her in Marvel Snap. That's who the main is, right? If you haven't been waiting on this, like what a choice. What a choice. This is like the deep cut idiosyncratic spinoff. It's like a Hellions, right? This little like idea that could, except it's Ultimate X-Men. It's the one. Wild. The confidence to let Peach Momoko do this. I love it. I love it so much. It's amazing, right? The build up for this is you have the Maker's lackeys are Sunfire, Viper, and Silver Samurai. Who are supposed to be controlling this territory of like, I don't know the geography of it well yet. I don't know exactly what we're dealing with. We also don't see those characters at all. So what their role is going to be, I do not know. What we see is like a little teen horror manga starring Armor developing her mutant ability, which seems to be probably like calling forth this like spirit guardian, right? Is kind of how her armor seems to manifest. I was getting Big Hero 6 energy from like that. What is that? That white robot Baymax, you know? You got that. I think it's going to tap into Peach's love of like using folklore and kind of spirits and stuff, which we saw in Demon Days, which is real cool stuff. Obviously, visually, it's off the charts cool. I mean, Peach just has we knew she had an incredible sense of style and just talent, right? You can see that just from the cover work. I think the pacing, the emotion, the grasp of tone and when to like let the book breathe, it's so nice. You know, it kind of reminds me one of my favorite eras of Marvel, and I think a lot of people's favorite eras, is the era of like Frank Miller Daredevil, John Byrne Fantastic Four, Walt Simonson Thor, Fantastic Four, Walt Simonson Thor, where you have the writer artist, you have the cartoonist, and kind of an auteur type directive. You know, it doesn't always have to be that. Obviously, writers and artists can work in tandem and collaborate, and that's the history of comics, and many amazing things happen in that, you know, system. But it's nice to have the writer-artist going as well. And Peach Momoko showed, like, and I think one thing the writer-artist often brings that a writer alone, it probably takes longer to grasp, is when you can just let the art speak for itself. You know? That's great. That should happen more. So many books are just so overstuffed with verbiage. You know, I read Ms. Marvel today as well, which I'm struck again how shockingly quickly good Iman Vellani is collaborating on these Ms. Marvel books. It's a solid book, but you compare the density of that and the amount of copy on the page that does not communicate anything as super special compared to Ultimate X-Men, which just has this knowledge and this sense of when and where to show detail, you know? Like, it's night and day. It really is. I think probably the biggest challenge, again, is even just aside from, like, where are my favorites, right? Like, this is, like, neither Ultimate Spider-Man nor Ultimate X-Men, or Ultimate Spider-Man nor Ultimate Black Panther had anywhere near the confidence to be like, we're going to hide from you your faves, right? Like Spider-Man, there's the Spider family. There's Jay Jonah and Uncle Ben having a good time in a bathhouse. There's Green Goblin. All the faves out on display. Ultimate Black Panther. There's T'Challa. There's Shuri. There's Storm. There's Killmonger. We're getting them all, baby. All the faves out on display. Ultimate X-Men. Here's armor, I guess. Here's maybe Shadow King. Maybe. Okay, I guess that's a theory, kind of a spoiler, but not, because I don't know that that's what's happening here. I mean, that's the leading fan brain idea. It could be entirely unrelated. I don't think Peach works in fan brain. Actually, I can tell you right now, she does not. Okay, so it's entirely possible that shadow that everybody's like, ooh, could that be Shadow King? Entirely possible it's something entirely new. Because Ultimate X-Men could actually be new. It could actually be different. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge it faces in terms of how this book connects and how it sells. Fortunately, it is also the most gorgeous book in the Ultimate Universe line. And I think that should push it forward. I'm seeing a lot of Junji Ito comparisons. Obviously, anytime you have a style like Peach's and obviously the manga influence and just Ito's, the sort of length, the shadow of his influence being as long as it is. Like, yes, I get it. It's not a horrific book, right? Like, it's a little dark, you know? I think, let's not overstate the Junji Ito-ness of Ultimate X-Men until it is earned, I think. But stylistically, I mean, I see why people are bringing it up. It's not necessarily a comp I would make, I don't think. But yeah, I love this book. It was great. I'm very curious if and when it will start doing some of the fan stuff. You know, I mentioned this heading into it, right? Like, this is not Peach Momoko's creator-owned universe. This is not Demon Days. Like what she does with Wolverine, you know, theoretically somebody else will have to pick up, right? Like if Hickman wants to use Wolverine, he'll be using Momoko's Wolverine. So what is that going to look like? Very interested in seeing that level, seeing how that is delivered. But yeah, this was awesome. Exactly what you want out of a new universe. You got Dennis Camp Ultimates coming. Put all your money in the Ultimate Universe. Every single dollar, every single Marvel dollar that I got is right here, right now. All right, what are people saying? I'm gonna get some. We got a sip today from our sponsor. Today's sponsor is Leftover Gym Water. We got a new sponsor today. This is Leftover Gym Water. If you went to the gym today and were working on your logo threes, a la Caitlin Clark, and you got some leftover water in your bottle, pour it down the pipes right now, take a swig, and reward yourself for shooting the ball every bit as well as Caitlin Clark herself. Big swig of old gym water. Let's see, we got on the question of who was Hickman's ultimate big bad. We got a few votes for Doug. That's a good twist. That would have been good. We got a few secondings of Ultron. We got Professor X still in play. A few Professor X's. Yeah, that one's still in play. Okay. Timothy says Ultron versus Nimrod. Who would win? Depends whose version of these characters we're talking about. House Powers Nimrod wins. Any other Nimrod in the history of Marvel Comics loses badly and frankly easily. What do we got? Banksy says, glad I read the Demon Day stuff so it didn't feel too crazy of a change to me. That's interesting. Yeah, it's a great time to go in. I mean, all those issues are in Marvel Limited. Check out the Demon Day stuff. Because it also has that sort of off-putting, like that thing that knocks your fan brain a little bit to the left, where it's inversions. It's almost what if-y. It's almost like Neil Gaiman's 1602, right? But even more flexible with character identity and like the concept of, you know, a Venom or whatever, right? But yeah, that definitely sets the tone for, I think, what not only what Ultimate X-Men is going to look like, but kind of how it's going to feel creatively. Most people seem to be digging Ultimate X-Men, which is good. Glad you're all on the same page. Let's see, we got a super chat from Really Rick. Said, take this money, man. Keep talking about these books. Thank you, Rick. Very appreciated. I will do that in your honor. Thank you very much. Let's see, you've got a lot of Shadow King. Does anyone think it's anything other than Shadow King? Aside from a new thing. Like my votes are Shadow King or new thing. I don't have an alternate X concept that I'm like anticipating here. I don't know if anybody else does. Let's see. All right. Other book that came out last week. Wait, did anything else come out today that we want to talk about? I mentioned Miss Marvel. My main Miss Marvel takeaway was Iman Vellani's pretty good at this. And with the creative team seems to understand Miss Marvel in positive ways. I think the book is like solid. It did kind of, to me, it calls attention to some of the oddness of mutant-ifying Kamala, you know, like making her this feared and hated character feels, I don't know that it's working. I guess, is my thing. Like, I don't know that Kamala as a mutant, it still feels off. It still feels awkward, I guess, is my main takeaway. Right? Like, it's not a great fit. It's kind of like Dame on the Bucks. It's like, we know the talent's there, but something's off here. Something doesn't feel like it used to. You know? All right. Getting your thoughts, getting your questions, getting your comments. Otherwise, I'm going to the Ewing Verst. Kenji says we do not want to talk about X-Men 32. Listen, I didn't read it. I just made a judgment call for my own mental health. If I would love it if someone in the comments would please tell me what happened in X-Men 32, and I will relay it to the crowd here in full detail. I'd be happy to. So last week, the big issue was Resurrection of Magneto number 2. You know what I love the most about Resurrection of Magneto number 2? Al brought back the Aqua Key. You know what I had forgotten about? The Aqua Key. Back in the Jonathan Hickman written giant-sized Magneto, when they were trying to get the island for the Hellfire Gala, and Magneto was like, yeah, I'll go on a little journey with you, Namor. And they went into the depths of the ocean, and they met some mysterious magical fish ladies, and they got a mysterious key, and we never spoke of it again until 3 years later. Oh, I love that Al Ewing brought that back. It made me so happy. Did I need an answer to that? No. But man, I just, the way Ewing is so, he is such a fan brain continuity wonk that just he rewards the most obsessive continuity fixations of a reader like myself in ways that I don't think anyone I've ever read live has. Maybe if I was reading Morrison's like Batman and I was a huge Batman head, you know, maybe there were some similar experiences probably that fans were having there. But it's just like nobody touches this stuff. Nobody is like, let me read all these books. Let me pull out the quirks. Let me weave that in an incredibly natural way. Because it's like the Aqua Key isn't even the focus of that book. The Aqua Key like barely matters, you know? It's just a MacGuffin. But just the fact that he went and pulled and was like, let me connect these dots. Nobody else makes that effort or finds that way. Jed McKay's pretty good at it when he wants to be at the continuity stuff. But man, just within this X era, I mean, Gillen's doing it because he has to, right? He has the job of tying knots. Al's just like, nobody asked. No, nobody demanded this, but I'm going to tie this knot for you anywhere because I care. I think that's why people are, you know, sometimes readers are like, why do you love Al Ewing stuff so much? Why do you love, you know, X-Men Red? It's not working for me. It's because of stuff like this. It's exactly because of stuff like this. This is why I'm an Al Ewing propaganda machine. Like, nobody else connects those dots. And it's fun when you have this grand tapestry. If we're going to play this game of reading too many comics all the time and caring and paying attention to what's happening, it's way more fun when somebody resolves it in a way that feels natural, you know, as opposed to just like, well, it's just lost and forsaken idea. And I guess that went nowhere. That's a disappointing experience. Al is all about taking out the disappointing experiences. And I really appreciate that. Really, really do. This is the Magneto Psyche book. You know, this is Magneto's in his own hell, a hell of his own making in a lot of ways, stands before his wall of the dead. It's an operatic testament to the history of the character. I'm going to talk about pulling from continuity, right? This is a deep dive on the history of Magneto, all the people he's killed throughout Marvel Comics history. Talks here about, first off, it's a great character study. Really good interaction between Storm and Magneto, as you'd expect. There's also a feeling here, and maybe this was meant to be more direct than I even read it as, of like, this is the official doing away with Resurrection book. Because when Magneto uses the Aqua Key and gets out of this hell, there's some line to the effect of like, the cost will be removing Resurrection. And I think that's something that I've kind of not been necessarily managing the logistics on, right? Or thinking too much about, because it's like, well, Kirkhall is going to go away, so you kind of expect Resurrection's going to be gone as well. But I think this is going to be sort of the in-story and continuity rationale for like, yeah, we can't resurrect anymore. Like, mutant life is going to become fragile again, you know? That, I don't know, did you all read it that way? Did you all read it like that's definitely what's happening here, that we're doing away with Resurrection? And then, you want to talk about Shadow King drops. Issue number 2 ends with an actual hardcore Shadow King drop. I didn't see that coming. Storm. Long relationship. History goes way back with Shadow King. Tail end of the Claremont era before the Jim Lee stuff takes over. And you got Shadow King in the book. looking awesome, might I add. I thought, is it Luciano Vecchio did this one? I thought the art was great in Resurrection Magneto. This is a fantastic comic. It is nice to have Resurrection of Magneto and Rise of Powers on the books as Krakoa hits its ending. It's a nice thing to have those books. Let's see. Seeing a lot of confirmation that Al Ewing is the continuity key. Cousin Marcus says Cassandra Nova as the possible Hickman Big Bad, I take it. That would have been of a piece with the Morrison affinity, certainly. What is the status of Cassandra post-Marauders? Was she, like, left in the past? In the Steve Orlando Marauder stuff? Is that what happened? Could be. Jasper says, could Mojo be the big bad in Ultimate X-Men? Oh, I hope not. I don't think I've ever been reading an X-Men story and thought, oh, good, Mojo's here. I am not feeling that. Immortal Thor number 7 came out last week as well. This book stays good. This is definitely one where, listen, it's got comics within comics. There's some real weird meta stuff going on where Loki and Thor are sort of reliving their older adventures on their journeys to understand the Utgards. You've got Enchantress manipulating ownership of these Thor stories. There's some meta commentary that I'm just inherently fascinated by. But it's also like, if I didn't trust Al Ewing a lot, we're 7 issues in, and I can't put my finger on what game he's playing exactly. I mean, you know, like, we're pretty deep into Immortal Thor. And I'm like, what exactly are we doing here? Am I just not getting it yet? You know? Because it's not enough to me to just, like, relive these stories and kind of Norse mythology it. Like, at some point, we got to deliver here on what is the Enchantress doing with Dario Agger and Executioner? Like, what is the impact of this? What's actually happening here? I thought we'd be getting a little closer to answers by this issue, honestly, by issue number 7. And it doesn't feel like we are yet. So, I mean, listen, I'm still curious. I'm enjoying the experience. The book looks nice. But I need a clue sooner than later. Before I turn on it, I think, you know, I need something. Because right now I'm like, what? What are you doing, Al? Where are we going? I don't get it yet. That's okay. But I want to know. I want to know. All right, what else? Dead X-Men number 2 came out last week as well. Dead X-Men is a strange book. On paper, I love everything about Dead X-Men. We got a crew of literal Dead X-Men who are traveling through Moira's lifelines, chasing a cybernetic Moira who's also traveling her lifelines, and they have no idea what the impact of potentially altering these lifelines could be. But it feels way too big and way too potentially impactful for what is a side quest in the grand scale of this very uneven event, right? Like, this could be the event. Could be like, we have to go to all of Evil Moira's alternate timelines. But instead, it's like this odd hodgepodge crew. It's a real cool idea, but it's just kind of hard to understand, like, what? We're doing this, we're finally doing this? But now, like, on the side, off to the side, it's a strange book. You know? I love the idea of it. I just, the ambition feels like it's outsized for what it's actually going to be able to deliver. It's a pretty wild book, though. You know? That first issue is definitely worth checking out. If you haven't checked out the first issue, I highly recommend it. Because it is definitely the tie-in that has relevance. I mean, no question there. All right. Getting your questions. Getting your thoughts. Do we have an X-Men 32 summary? I don't think we do. No one dares. No one dares to summarize X-Men 32. Oh, wait, Xavier said something. Said, X-Men 32 tried to make the preparation of the comeback of the good guys exciting. Nice try. Let's see if they land it next month or if they finally move. Okay. MemJ says, Polaris lands on Earth, finally, and removes magic's power-suppressing nanites, and Kate reunites with Lockheed. were they not together? Okay. Okay. I think we just recapped X-Men 32. Good job, everybody. Yeah, like I said, Dead X-Men is the relevant tie-in to be considering. All right, getting your final questions, getting your final thoughts. Otherwise, oh, I said I was going to show you all the sketch draft, but we've got like 2 seconds. I can't stay that much longer. I don't know that I've gotten any children's recommendations yet today either. Does that mean all of you are too young and I'm the only old dad in the group? Is that what's happening here? It makes sense that I'd have a lot of younger listeners, right? That you would all look up to me and be like, wow, this guy's so cool. Seems similarly young. I'd love to listen to him for extended periods of time. That connects. I can see that. When he talks about going to the gym and hoisting threes, I'm sure he's not wearing a knee brace. I'm sure he doesn't need 3 Advil before he goes every single time. He's definitely not taking extensive stretching breaks in between. It's probably, I imagine these are the thoughts that all of you are having. Xavier says, give us the link. Well, so the link to the podcast is just off panel. Podcast, right? So you can find that wherever you find your pods. It's on sketched.com, and I'll put it in the chat. I'll put a link in the chat. I'm not beyond that. Here we go. The Uncanny X-Draft with Dave Busing. That's me. I'll put it right here. It is. I had a really fun time doing it, and people seem to enjoy it. So check out that podcast if you're so inclined. I mean, listen, I guess I can. We're here. We're all here. That's not what we want to see. We want to see this. The spreadsheet. I made a spreadsheet so that I could appropriately draft my X series and writers and artists and colorists and letterers and covers. Were the colorists and letterers and colors requested? No, they were not. Thank you for asking. Okay, everything in yellow, I think, is ultimately what I picked. It's what I got to pick. But the stuff that is not in yellow is the stuff I didn't get to draft. So like for the first pick of the draft, if you haven't listened, I choked. I said I wanted the first pick because I knew, okay, there's going to be a big Uncanny X-Men book. And I think it's going to be an ongoing. I think I'm going to predict that is happening. But I was thinking like James Tynion IV would be super cool on that book. That'd be a nice, get a lot of attention. Then I read an interview that David did with James, and he was like, I'm definitely not writing superhero comics, paraphrasing heavily. But that was the vibe of it. And I was like, well, shoot, I can't pick him. So then I put in Turtles Crowd, I put in Sophie Campbell and Tom Waltz, and I was like, that doesn't feel right either. And then I put in Gail Simone. And in retrospect, given where we started this conversation, I should have just gone for it. But even then, I was like, I just don't, is she really doing it? Really? That's how they announced it with this free comic book day thing? So I kind of choked, and then I just said, I'm going to go with the safest pick. So I went Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo on Wolverine. Because we know Greg Capullo is doing some sort of Wolverine thing. That's a lead pipe lock. So that's where I went with the first pick. I should have had the guts. I should have had the guts in retrospect to go Uncanny, Gail Simone, Elena Casagrande, Elsa Chartier on the Emma Frost flashbacks. You didn't know there were Emma Frost flashbacks in the new Uncanny X-Men? Yeah, there's going to be. There's definitely going to be. Okay, the book that I probably most wish I had picked that I didn't would be X-Men by Cody Ziegler and Sanford Green. I think that would be super cool. Ziegler's doing the Miles book right now for Marvel. I think he's going to be writing the ongoing Deadpool. Was announced shortly after we did this draft. The fact that he's announced on Deadpool makes me think probably this isn't also happening. So, you know, in the sense of like I'm trying to get things right, that's probably a good thing. But I think that'd be a super cool book. Sanford Green is doing that Doctor Doom one shot with Hickman. Did Beirut for a long time. Did a really cool Iron Fist book with Marvel. The more Green we could get in the X office, the better off we'd be. The other book that I wish I had picked, and again, this is factored into two categories. There's the books that I want, And then there's the books that I think are going to happen. So listen, don't freak out when you're like, oh my gosh, he wants a John Byrne book and a Dan Slott, Humberto Ramos book. No, I just think those are in play. I think those are very much in play in the new Tom Brevoort administration. The wants that I didn't pick that I most would have liked, Storm by Stephanie Williams and Sloan Leong, I think would have been awesome. And Exiles by Hassan Oltzman Elhau and Junie Ba would have rolled. But again, that's another one where Junie's now on like a, he's doing like a Robbins book for DC Black Label. And what's the other one? Some Turtle stuff, probably. So I feel like that's probably not happening either. So there you go. There's the sneak peek behind the curtain of my in-depth draft board. This right here is the draft board that I had created. So I could do the Lil Ole Uncanny X-Draft, which again was incredibly fun. All right, let's see. What thoughts do we have on this? Okay. Pepto says, waiting for Dave to slowly transition to DC new books. Oh, what are we going to do post-X-Men? Is that what the conversation is here? Is that what the thought is? Okay, I think post-Krakoa, what are we going to talk about? I'm going to keep it a mystery. I'm going to keep going with the Ultimate Universe, assuming that stays super interesting. But then I probably just want to talk more about like good comics. So we will do that. Check out the episode that I did with David. Boost my stats, boost my numbers, make me look good. And, you know, otherwise, thanks for listening. Appreciate you being here. Talk comics. This was fun. I will be back next week. Let's see, what do we got? I'll do my best of February for sure, because next week is an Immortal Thor number 8. It is an Ultimate Black Panther number 2. And it's Fall of House of X number 3. I'll be honest, I don't know that I'm going to read that. I might need you all to recap it for me in the comments. But we'll definitely talk about Ultimate Black Panther, Immortal Thor, and then we'll talk about the best comics that I've read recently. Thanks, everybody, for listening. See you next week. Enjoy the comics.